Jason Howell reports from Google I.O. Mark Gurman from Bloomberg tells us what to expect with the new macOS, the new iOS, and the new watchOS. Will Arimus from Medium tells us what happens when Satan slid into his DMs. And Owen J.J. Stone has some words for me about letting my kids play video games. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 82, recorded Thursday, May 9th, 2019. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Find the right people for your business this year at linkedin.com/technews and get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. And by Envoy. Envoy builds beautiful modern software to help businesses elevate the physical workplace experience. With Envoy visitors, you can greet guests with a welcoming, sleek iPad sign-in app while still protecting your people, property, and ideas. Start your free trial today at envoy.com/twit. And by FreshBooks, the number one accounting software in the cloud for self-employed professionals and their teams. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/TNW. Hello. Welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell from Google I.O. in Mountain View. How are you doing, Megan?
I am doing great. It's so great to have you. It's better when you're here, but...
Yeah. I'm kind of there. I mean, I'm digitally there. It's weird to see me digitally over here, but they are represented in a TV set. It's kind of a mind bend.
It really is. Yeah. I would make you prove that you're you, but I'm going to just trust you.
Here, I'll pinch myself. Yep, it's definitely me. That
good,
hurts.
Good. So Google I.O. is sort of wrapping up at this point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Things are winding down. Definitely a lot emptier here in the press room. It's like a press area. Obviously, it's outdoors, but this place was jam-packed a couple of days ago. Usually that very first day, tons of excitement. You know, all the keynotes are happening. In this case, the hardware announcement's happening. So a lot of buzz and excitement then. It's really tapered off now. And at the end of today, it's all done, completely done.
And so everybody's been posting their highlights, but I want to know what yours were. Like, what was the biggest, let's start with the biggest highlight for you.
Well, I think it's hard to talk about Google I.O. without kind of starting with the hardware announcement, specifically because Google hasn't really done a whole lot of hardware announcements at Google I.O. in recent years. They really tapered off from that. But we knew this was coming. The Pixel 3a, which I have the 3a XL right here. I've been using it since they kind of gave it to the press to review a couple of days ago. So it's been my driver, you know, throughout Google I.O. The 3a XL, you know, they made a really good case for this, right? Like, it's a $400 device. If you had to classify it, it would kind of fall into that mid-range tier. But many people here seem to be saying, like, why do you get the full-priced 3 now when the 3a is half the cost and still, you know, still has the things that you really want out of a Pixel? That camera, you know, first and foremost, the camera is the same rear-facing camera as on the 3 and the 3 XL. And so everybody knows the Pixel brand for its strength in cameras. And knowing that you can get that for $400 just in the mid-range tier, there's a lot of devices that are nice, but the camera always seems to be the trade-off. And here, it's kind of the opposite. It's like the camera is the biggest strength. And if that's really important to you, this is a great option.
So is there anything in, you have the Pixel 3, is there anything in the Pixel 3 that is not in the 3A?
So not in the 3A. Well, so what are the trade-offs? The 3A has a lower powered processor. It's kind of a mid-range Snapdragon processor. It's a new one. And in my playing with it, I've seen very little in the ways of slowdown and stuff. You're probably not going to do any hardcore gaming on this or whatever. But as far as, you know, camera performance, navigating Chrome, you know, throughout the OS in general, things are pretty slick. It has a plastic design, which I feel like is hardly a drawback. It might even make it more susceptible to, you know, surviving a drop. But they did a really good job of making it feel close to the original glass design. It has an OLED display that I would say is not as bright in the outdoors. It really reminds me of the Nexus 5 display. You know, so it's solid enough. It's 1080p. Those are kind of the trade-offs, you know, and if you're willing to deal with those going, you know, those changes in order to get that really strong camera performance and Google's commitment to updating it, which goes a long way, I think this is a really good device, and it makes me question why I would recommend anyone buy the 3 right now.
And so when do we think the 4 will come out?
Well, that usually that, I mean, if previous announcements are to, you know, be followed as far as like a trend, it would happen sometime in October. And I think this really makes me curious what Google's going to do on the 4, because the design of the of 1 through 3 have been very similar. Obviously, the 3A looks a lot. I mean, it looks almost identical to the design of the 3. I feel like Google has to come out of the gate with the 4 and do something really different. And, you know, they've really stuck to the single camera design on the back because they say, well, we've got AI and software that can bring all these features without more hardware. I keep thinking, well, yeah, but if you take that software and that AI and apply it to more hardware, just think of what you can pull off, right? They're going to have to really justify why people pay premium price for a phone, especially when they have a phone that's half the price that's doing the most of the important stuff of their current premium device. It's got to really stand out.
So you did a first look on Hot Hands on Tech, our show, and Leo did an unboxing. Is there anything else we need to talk about with the Pixel before we move on to Assistant?
No, other than to say that I'm playing around with it. So far, I really like it, actually. I have a case on it that's almost identical to the case that I have on my 3, and very, very often I can't tell which one I'm using. You know, there's few trade-offs, like the notch would be the giveaway, the big giveaway, but that tells me something. So full review coming to Hands on Tech sometime within the next week or so.
So there was a big demo, a big assistant demo that everyone was super excited about, being able to stop a timer without saying the Google wake word. Tell us about what else Assistant can do.
I just thought it was so funny. That was one of the few things that I tweeted about. And then when I really thought about it, I was like, man, if I'm getting excited about not having to, you know, say, hey, G, in order to stop my timer, like, what does that say about the quality of these announcements? That might be, you know, that might be putting it a little bit too rough on Google. Assistant, I think what really surprised me and interests me about Assistant, because Assistant is a drumbeat that Google always, you know, is pounding every year at Google I.O. This time what they're talking about is they're talking about miniaturizing, about shrinking down all of the machine learning mechanisms and fitting them onto the device, right? So they're talking about drastic improvements on taking these models that currently exist in the cloud, shrinking them down so that they can exist on your smartphone. And what does that do? That improves privacy implications, right? That keeps, in what from what Google was saying, that keeps them from receiving all of this information. So that makes privacy-minded individuals a little bit happier. It also makes things really, really fast. And they had a really impressive performance demonstration on stage where a woman was just like rattling off command after command after command into her phone, and it was doing all sorts of stuff, full control of the device, which actually kind of reminded me of what Samsung's Bixby does. But of course, this will get used a lot more than Bixby does. Composing an email, setting timers, navigating between apps, doing all this stuff in real time. And I mean, there was little to no pause between any of it. Really impressive, and I'm really looking forward to that coming to mobile, because that's going to be the next step in, you know, how we talk to our devices. That normal speed bump of, okay, now I got to wait for it to process my language, send it to the cloud. Oh, it got it right, or it got it wrong. Hopefully that this helps that.
So their idea is, I mean, you would have to give them a lot of information in order for, you know, they'd have to know a lot about you in order to be your real personal assistant. But their big argument was, but we're not going to share this with other people as we have in the past.
I think what Google's messaging around this is interesting, right? Because on one hand, they're saying, and they said it at the very top of the keynote, you know, our big focus this year is about privacy and security. But then they come out and they say, you know, show off these assistant features, and they say out of the other side of their mouth, yeah, but you know, this is only really going to be useful if you're giving us all your data. And I think what they're saying in all of this is, you've already given us 20 years of search data, or however long Google's been around collecting all of this data, right? And check out all the cool things we can do with it. Is that important to you? Is that worth the trade-off for you? Great. If not, here's some controls to be able to kind of clamp down on that. I don't know if they've gone far enough with that, but that's kind of their messaging. And so I don't know. Supposedly that's supposed to make people on both sides of the camp happy, and maybe it just leaves both sides of the camp feeling unsatisfied with the answer.
Yeah. So live captions, I've heard about that. Is that part of Assistant, or is that something totally different?
This is something that's totally different, and I'm really curious to play around with this. It's not on the Android Q Beta 3 yet, which I do have on my 3XL right now, and I've been playing around with that. But live caption, I think this is really important, right? Accessibility has long been one of the iPhone's big strengths. Anyone who has, you know, reason for accessibility features would say that the iPhone has the better platform for this. I don't think that this changes that fact, but I do think that this gives Android a really, you know, quality gem of a feature that people with, you know, accessibility necessities are going to be asking for out of the iPhone in the future. Because what this does, it runs in the system. You actually pull it up through your, you know, when you change the volume, you get this like volume control pop up on your phone. It adds a little extra option there to turn live caption on. And then any audio that's feeding through from videos, it could be recorded on your device. It could be a live video stream from your video camera app. It could be videos on YouTube, Vimeo, wherever it is. Instead of having to process these these captions ahead of time, it's doing it in real time. And again, this all goes back to bringing that machine learning onto the device itself, so it's not happening in the cloud. It's just a really impressive demonstration of where we're headed with machine learning and the miniaturization of all of these models so that they can fit on the device. Which, by the way, we were talking earlier about the Pixel 4 and what it needs. I think this is a big part of it. They mentioned at one point that things, you know, some of these advanced machine learning features aren't necessarily going to be available on every single device. It'll be available on, air quotes, the next Pixel. And that's why they're going to need something with a lot of onboard power in order to churn through some of this stuff. I don't know if that relates to live captions specifically, but it definitely relates to some of those advanced assistant features we were talking about before.
So would it work in like a video call? Like if I wanted to call someone, you know, like if I'm calling it FaceTime, the generic word, but you know, whatever you guys do on Hangouts, I guess,
or Skype. Who the heck knows what we do, to be honest. So I'm even confused about that.
Would it be that, so if I wanted to call someone who was hearing impaired, then I might be able to do a video call and they could, and it would be live captioned?
Absolutely. Isn't that cool? Like, yeah. That is so amazing. Like, think of what that opens up. And it's not just for accessibility features. Like, how many times have I been caught in the wormhole of, like, you know, navigating through Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and a video player shows up and they've already got the transcriptions built in there. So many times, like, I don't even turn up the volume. I just read it because that's convenient about where I'm at right then. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be a really big feature.
So let's go back to privacy. They talked a little bit about how they're giving you back the control of privacy. Was there more that you wanted to talk about that?
No, I mean, that's just a general focus and a general theme. They're putting private, they've added a privacy section into the main settings panel on Android, something that you had to really dig for before. And I think that's just emblematic of Google's kind of renewed kind of direction of saying, hey, you want access to these controls, here you go. They're also giving, you know, bringing a lot of new privacy features to the OS, things like controls over location sharing, you know, whether you want it only running when the app is running, which is super helpful. Something called scoped storage, which is more developer-y, but you can think of it as like a file system sandbox on a per app basis. Background app controls, controls over ad targeting, even in the settings. Just a whole bunch of ways that Google's saying, we hear you want control over your data, here you go. But like I said, they're good changes. One could easily see them as being meant to imply Google is taking privacy seriously without the company actually really focusing on the bigger issues happening behind the scenes. And that's some of the criticism that we're hearing.
And in terms of security, one thing they always talk about is getting updates faster. They announced something new, Project Mainline.
Yeah, this one's really exciting to me. And I don't know how if it's exciting to everyone here, but this one really caught my attention. 2 years ago, they did something called Project Trouble, where they really did a lot of work on componentizing the operating system. And that was ultimately to make updates to the operating system easier for OEMs to roll out. But of course, 2 years later, it's had mixed results as far as what that's done. But that started a trend of piecing out parts of Android so that things can be updated where other things are left untouched. And that's what Project Mainline is all about. It pushes the idea further. It's meant to separate from the monthly security patch schedule and update pieces of the phone as needed, kind of going around the OEMs. Now, OEMs agree to this when they install Google's Android Q on their devices, which basically what that means is through those coordinations, there's like 12 at this point core components inside the operating system that are updatable. So, for example, media codecs is one of those. If this was in place when stage fright happened, Google could have applied an update to all of its supported phones that have this feature, and it would have minimized the time it took to patch, because as we know, that was kind of a cluster F. So this would have been a great way around that. And that's just one example. But I'm super hopeful about what this means for the OS going forward, because I think this is critical. This is a critical issue that Google needs to address.
So you're going to come on Twit, the big Sunday show, so you can talk at length about everything that you saw. You're tweeting about it, I presume?
I'm tweeting when I have things to tweet about. But yeah, I'm having a lot of fun here. I'm going to wrap things up. Florence Ion, my co-host on All About Android, she sits down with Hiroshi Lockheimer, the head of Android, here at a fireside chat on stage. So there's going to be a ton of people in the audience and live online watching. She's also going to be on Twit this weekend, so she's going to talk a lot about that. I'm really looking forward to that. That's what's up next for me.
Awesome. Well, we hope to see you when you're back in the office next week.
Thank you, Megan. This is a lot of fun being a guest today.
All right. Take care. Have fun.
All right. Bye.
After the break, find out how iOS 13 might nag you about how loud you play your music. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Any person you hire can make a huge impact on your business, sometimes good, sometimes bad. That is why it is so important to find the right person, the good person. But where are you, perfect employee? You can post a job on a job board and hope that that perfect employee will find your job listing. But let's think about it for a minute. How often do you hang out on random job boards? Don't leave finding someone great to chance when you can post your job to a place where people go every day to make connections, grow in their career, and discover job opportunities. That place I'm talking about, of course, is LinkedIn. I'm going to ask you a question. Guess how much of the U.S. workforce is on LinkedIn? Go ahead, guess. You have a number in your mind. Are you thinking of 70%? Because that's what it is. 70% of the U.S. workforce is on LinkedIn. There's a pretty good chance that that perfect person is part of that 70%. Here's another good stat for you. A company hires someone every 8 seconds using LinkedIn. So do not wait. Share your company story and attract the right talent. Do it now. Go to linkedin.com/technews and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/technews to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. That's linkedin.com/technews. Apple's big developer conference starts in about a month, and the company will once again walk the fine line of trying to convince developers to create fantastic apps while also showing off an operating system that might make those apps obsolete. Joining us to talk about this is Mark Gurman from Bloomberg. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So you wrote a great piece on Bloomberg about iOS 13. What apps do you expect to be Sherlocked this year?
Which apps do I expect to be Sherlock? Well, there's going to be a big upgrade to the health tracking capabilities. There's going to be a new sleep mode. There's going to be a downloads manager in Safari. So anything that touches upon those are going to perhaps be in trouble. The biggest app overhaul is going to be to the Reminders application. So any of those high-end to-do list apps, unless they're super high-end and have some very unique functionality, they could too be in trouble. And of course, this is nothing new. Apple's always coming out with new features while also asking developers to write better apps.
Yeah, it's so hard because I use Reminders pretty regularly and it doesn't really do anything special at all. There are so many other apps that are so much better, but it's just built in. It's just right there. And it, I hope for my sake that it's upgraded, but for all those people who have been creating amazing reminder-like apps, I do feel bad about them. So I want to talk about the health app, because you wrote that there's going to be some certain features in there, including something that's going to tell me if my music is too loud.
Yeah, so that's one new section there's going to be in the health application is called Hearing Health. So it will be able to tell you if you're playing music too loud on your headphones. It'll allow you to track how loud the music is. But you'll also be able to understand and engage how loud your external environment is. So a focus there. And throughout the system, there's also going to be a bigger push both on accessibility. So there's going to be a new accessibility settings menu at the top level of the settings app. But there's also going to be enhanced integration for those who use hearing aids. So hearing aids that can integrate with iOS. And that's going to expand to the new update to the Apple Watch as well.
And that's great. I mean, hearing health is so important. It does. I'm sure that they're going to talk about privacy. They're not actually listening to what people are saying around me. It's just the noise levels, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a noise level thing. It doesn't have to do with some of these other controversies that we've been hearing about in terms of actually knowing what people are talking about around you. So that's not a part of it, no. Right.
So what about the newest version of macOS? What do we expect to see there?
So the big news there, as we've been writing about for a while, is that iPad apps, third-party iPad apps, are now going to be able to run on the Mac. And so what developers are going to do if they have an iPad application is that they can tweak it using a new software development kit they're going to announce at WWDC to also run on the Mac. So you'll be able to submit both an iPad version of an iPad app and a Mac version of an iPad app. And they have sort of a long roadmap ahead of how they're going to integrate iPhone apps, iPad apps, and Mac apps into one single download.
It's so funny. This morning I was using my iPad with a keyboard and my Mac, and almost in the same 5 minutes, I was tapping my Mac screen to try to get it to do something, and then using my iPad which doesn't have a trackpad, and just like, you know, you do that thumb thing where your thumb reaches down for the trackpad. So I just foresee, like, with more app crossover, there's just going to be more. I just want one device, but that's not going to happen, is it?
No. Eventually, I think they're going to have to do something, but it just doesn't sound like they're going to. So it's an odd choice, in my opinion. But, you know, if they get rid of the Mac, that's going to be a big sales engine loss. So I don't know. I think at the end of the day, they'll have to do something, but I don't think it's anything in the near term.
And what about Mac Pros? What do we expect to see in hardware?
So the Mac Pro is something that I'm sure a lot of your audience, a lot of developers, are very excited about. This is going to be a several $1,000 computer, be able to expand the components, interchange components. It'll be somewhat similar to the cheese grater Mac Pro that they released, you know, I don't know, 15 years ago now. Won't look like that, won't be as big, but it'll be very modular. You'll be able to replace components in and out. Developers and professional users, video editors, photos, those people are going to want this machine. That's what it's for them. There's also a new display in the works. It's a 6K monitor. It's going to be very, very expensive, but it's going to look also very good. So that will also be on the docket for WWDC.
And what about the Apple Watch? What improvements will we see in that software?
Yeah, I think the Apple Watch might be getting a really big update this year. They're trying to make it more independent. So what they're going to do is they're going to bring along some of the apps on the iPhone that are currently on the phone, but not on the watch. So a few of those will be the Apple Books app. Won't be able to read on the very small Apple Watch screen, but it'll be for audiobooks. There's also going to be a calculator application for calculations on the go. If you're the type of person who wants to use a calculator watch like they did in the 1980s and 1990s, there's going to be a slew of new watch faces and complications to be able to get, you know, rain data on your watch face. There's going to be a few other ways to see the time. But the big addition is going to be voice memos as well as the App Store. So the App Store will be on the watch itself. Now, it's unclear how well that will work since the screen is so small and the App Store has so many applications, but that's what they're doing. They're moving the store from the phone app, the companion app for the watch, to the watch itself. So you could be out and about, leave your phone behind, and download applications over your cellular network or a Wi-Fi network that you're connected to.
That's amazing. So you say that we're going to get a calculator. I already use pCalc, an independent app, on my Apple Watch. And that developer, he's been working for Apple, you know, working on Apple products, used to work for Apple, doesn't anymore. And so how does Apple lure these developers and really just say, like, we love you, we want you to keep making apps, you know, basically so they can take 30% of of everything, but we're also going to use what you've created, see how people like it and use it and make it ourselves, and then, you know, sorry for you.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate for these developers who spend so much time and money, resources developing these things, and then having Apple sort of, like you said, Sherlock them and come out with their own versions of those applications. You know, I don't know what to tell those developers, but, you know, some of these independent developers, like the one you mentioned for pCalc, you know, they have a very large and dedicated audience, and I don't see developers like that going away anytime soon. So I think they'll fight through this, and if history is any guide, Apple's calculator app functionality will definitely not be as advanced as pCalc. Mm-hmm. Likewise for the other new apps that they'll be launching.
Yeah, that's James Thompson, who is the developer. And yeah, he has a more developed app, calculator app for the iPad and for the, yeah, it's true. Like, you, I guess the best advice is do a lot of stuff. Don't just put all your developing eggs in one basket. So do you think we'll hear more about the services that more details about the services that we didn't hear about, like how much it's going to cost for the game subscription service on iOS, or more about the credit card they talked about, like how there's going to be a finance app. Do you think we're going to hear more details that we didn't hear about those services in the last event?
I think so. On the Apple Card, we might get an update on that. Maybe they'll be more specific on the timing, how that development is going. Apple Arcade, I think, is going to be for sure something discussed, because something so core to the Apple Arcade service is this new way of running iPad apps on Macs, right? Because that's basically going to be a core piece of this, being able to run the same game on all of Apple's hardware platforms. And this change coming to the Mac is at the center of making that happen. So I think for sure we'll hear about that. I don't believe they even revealed pricing for the Apple exact timing. So I think they're going to say, hey, that's going to be part of these new OS updates. And so that will be something discussed in some detail at WWDC, whether that's at the main keynote or one of the side keynotes specific to developers later in the week.
So if apps are going to run, if the same games or apps are going to run on iOS and macOS, does that mean for consumers, will they have to pay twice for those games since the developers aren't developing them twice?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll answer that in terms of the third-party iPad apps in general. So right now, it seems like they are going to be separate applications. So I think developers will have sway if they want to charge twice for the iPad version on the Mac, in addition to the iPad version on the iPad. But in terms of the gaming service that you mentioned in particular, I think that's going to be part of one subscription bundle. So that's not something that will be charged twice. That will be something that you have probably a $10 or $15 monthly fee, runs on all of your hardware devices, but you're paying just that fee. You're not paying a single download price.
Right. Mark Gurman writes about Apple and devices for Bloomberg. You can read his piece on everything to expect at WWDC this year. Plus, he has a great explainer on how the Apple Store has lost its luster. Find that on Bloomberg.com. Mark, thank you. It is always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Take care. After the break, what happens when Satan slides into your DMs? But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Envoy. It's time to welcome guests to the modern lobby and for you to be ready for everything that comes through your front door. Envoy Visitors is an iPad kiosk that makes workplaces more efficient. How does Envoy Visitors work? Let me tell you. When visitors arrive, they sign in on an iPad kiosk. They enter their details and then sign all the legal documents you have for them, you know, like NDAs and so forth. They sign up right on the iPad. Envoy then notifies their host, and then Envoy will automatically alert your employee when a guest arrives. That saves you time and hassle. Your employee knows who's coming and when, making awkward meetings a thing of the past. Awkward meetings in the office anyway. I can't help you on what you do in your own time. That you can be awkward all you want. I can't help you there. But Envoy Visitors can help you in the office. Boost your office efficiency with smart security that doesn't intimidate. There's no more paper login book that doesn't provide any real value. No more paper, no more tree killing. You sign in unlimited visitors, print customized badges, Send alerts when VIPs arrive. It even notifies administrators about unattended guests. You can integrate with your existing security system. So it has Wi-Fi access, ID checks, emergency notifications, giving you advanced security. Finally, you'll have data on the visitors in your office so you know who's coming, when they're on site, who they're meeting with, and even why. Envoy Visitors works with tools you already use, such as Slack, G Suite, Box, and Salesforce, Chatter, just to name a few. They're designed to help companies of all types, including those in highly regulated industries. They'll help you meet security and compliance requirements. Join companies like Nike, Pinterest, and Spotify that have worked with Envoy to welcome over 30 million visitors. Protect your people, property, and ideas the welcoming way with Envoy. See why 10,000 workplaces worldwide choose Envoy to make a great first impression. Go to envoy.com/twit and start your free trial today. That's envoy.com/twit. Tech reporter Will Arimus was minding his own business one day when Satan slid into his DMs and asked for help. Will is here to tell that story. Welcome to the show, Will.
Hey, thanks for having me, Megan.
So tell us how you met Satan on Twitter.
So I woke up one morning and checked my notifications on my phone, and it said, "You've received a direct message on Twitter from Satan." I thought, you know, that's a little weirder than the notifications I wake up to most mornings, but not that much weirder. I figured it was spam or something. Turns out it was a real person. It's the Satan parody account on Twitter. He has close to 1 million followers, and he was having some trouble with his Twitter account. He wanted to know if I could help him in any way.
So his problem was that he was losing followers. So Satan wanted your help to get more followers, essentially. And you said,
when you put it that way,
yeah. So at first you were kind of like, that's not what I do. I'm a tech reporter. I report on people's problems. I don't fix them. But then you decided to help anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I actually got intrigued by what was going on, because it seemed like he was being affected by something I wrote about a year ago, and it's one of Twitter's more misunderstood safety and security features. This is a feature where they use automated software to hide certain accounts in the replies to a tweet, and also to hide them in search results. So basically, your account is getting downgraded. It's not being shown in public views. You can still tweet. All your followers can still see your tweets, but you're just not going to really earn any new followers that way. You're not going to be able to contribute to the public conversation. The thinking behind this is a way that Twitter can kind of keep trolls out of sight without having to actually manually go in and catch them breaking some rule explicitly. It can just look at accounts where their behavior or other people's interactions with them suggest that they are spammy or that they are off topic or rude or vulgar or whatever. And then, you know, without having to have any human review it, their software can just make those accounts less visible to everybody. And it looked like that's what was happening to Satan. And I was curious to figure out why.
So from what I understand from your piece, Satan was getting a lot of followers from his relationship with Donald Trump, correct? Like he would respond to Trump's tweets, as many, many people do. And then people would see that and think it was hilarious and then follow him. And maybe that's where people were no longer seeing his tweets.
That's one place they were no longer seeing his tweets. So, yeah, in the past, he had done several replies to Donald Trump tweets that ended up being one of the top replies, which means that they get seen by millions of people. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of fans of Donald Trump, particularly Christian fans of Donald Trump, reported that or otherwise flagged his tweets. And maybe that was part of what happened here. But also, if you searched for Satan on Twitter, if you typed S-A-T-A-N into the search bar, his account wouldn't come up anymore. It used to be the top one, and it wasn't coming up anymore. So again, his followers could still see his stuff, but he was unable to keep growing his Satan brand.
And so Twitter made this change. Maybe if you were a tech reporter like you, you knew that they were making this change. But no one who was affected by this change was notified at all. Unlike in the past, when sometimes, you know, there's other ways in which you'll get alerts saying, like, you've been, you know, put in timeout on Twitter for whatever reason. But for this, people had no idea, right?
That's right. So if you get suspended by Twitter, they will let you know. And they now, at least, will tell you what you did wrong or what rule you're presumed to have violated. And then you can kind of get in touch with them and try to get reinstated. Sometimes they'll give you a specific action you can take. Like if you delete these three tweets, then your account can be reinstated. But yeah, that's not what they're doing here. They're doing something that is more on a mass scale. It's entirely automated, and they're kind of trying to thread a needle here, right? They want to be able to affect accounts or downgrade accounts that they suspect people don't like seeing without having to go through the full enforcement process. And they decided at the beginning that they weren't going to tell people when this happened to their accounts. The people didn't necessarily have a right to know because, again, they were still tweeting. They just weren't as visible anymore. Twitter considers that part of its algorithm that shows people the most interesting tweets, the most relevant tweets, rather than considering it like an enforcement action or an action that deprives someone of the right to speak on Twitter. It just makes them less likely to be heard. Now, that has lent itself to misinterpretation, as I sort of predicted when they rolled this out. Conservatives, early on, some conservative leaders and even some Republicans in Congress found that they were getting caught up by this feature and that their tweets were not showing up. Actually, it was that they weren't showing up in search results anymore. Twitter said that was a mistake and a bug, and they fixed it, but not before conservatives had decided that this was a shadow ban and that it was biased against conservatives. And since then, there have been congressional hearings. Apparently, it was a topic when Donald Trump met with Jack Dorsey. So they've made a lot of enemies with this feature that's come to be known as a shadow ban, even though it isn't quite technically a shadow ban as we've previously known it.
I mean, and you can understand, well, if there's true trolls that are doing something, you know, we wouldn't, you know, Twitter would not benefit by saying, like, you're doing this very specific thing and that's why we're stopping you, because they might find a way around of it, I guess, or they might just stop being trolls, although they probably wouldn't. But it's the idea that you don't know, and for a person like Satan, who is making his living, trying to make a living off Twitter, would link to a store where he was sold merch. And then just for this to disappear and to have no reason to no understanding why, I mean, it can drive up these kinds of, you can see why algorithms drive people crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like he has no control over it. And not only that, but he tried to tweet at Twitter. He tweeted at Jack. He tweeted at Del Harvey, who's their VP of Trust and Safety. He tweeted at Support, which is their customer support account. He tweeted at the ads account. He did everything he could to think of to get in touch with somebody at Twitter to figure out why this was happening and how he could fix it. Nobody got back to him. And still, even since my story, he says that nobody has gotten back to him or reached out to him. Yeah, your account is getting affected by Twitter's algorithm, and there's no, you know, you're not given a heads up. There's no recourse. There's literally nothing you can do about it. And so it does understandably make somebody feel helpless, and even made me feel a little bit of sympathy for the devil in this case.
And so Twitter did respond to you in one way, and Satan had not always owned this account, or owned it and sold it and bought it back, or there was some transferring of accounts, and Twitter said maybe that has to do with why he was being muted or something.
Yeah, and that gets at one of the troubles with transparency on Twitter and other social platforms, is that the platforms don't like to talk publicly about an individual account. And that's partly for privacy reasons or reasons of sort of a power disparity between the company and any individual user. But they kind of hinted to me, without saying as much, that maybe it was because some other account they had managed to link to this account that as being owned by the same person, and that one had gotten in trouble somehow or run afoul of Twitter's rules, and so the Satan account was being affected as well. But that wasn't a definitive answer. They still haven't told Satan himself, who's, by the way, a 26-year-old British lad who works in a shop. That's the person behind the Satan account. So they didn't tell him about it, and that was just sort of the best hint I could get from them as to why this might be the case. He did admit that he had gotten that account from somebody else years ago. He thinks it would be a little strange if something that happened 6 or 8 years ago was just affecting his account now, but that's a possibility. And again, I'm not going to rule out the possibility that Satan didn't do something very wrong that we just don't know about, that I don't know about, but Twitter couldn't point me to anything in particular that he had done wrong or that violated its rules.
And so at the heart of this story is this kind of idea, you know, where you're talking about conservatives saying there's the shadow bans and this idea of free speech that we hear all the time. But one thing that you talk about in your article is free speech versus free reach. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So this program by Twitter, I mean, I'm giving it a hard time here because I think there are flaws with it. But there's also a really understandable rationale behind it, I think. So an idea that has sort of gained currency among critics of social platforms recently is this idea of free speech but not free reach. Rene DiResta, who's testified before Congress on this kind of stuff, is one of the people who's championed this idea. And the thought is, look, all right, you have people who are saying hateful stuff or bigoted stuff or potentially dangerous stuff on social platforms that a lot of people don't want to see. At the same time, you don't necessarily want to be in the business of denying people the right to speak unless you really, you know, unless it's really egregious or unless there's a clear rules violation. So what if there are ways that these social platforms can make sure their algorithms aren't amplifying these people, right? Like still give them the chance to speak, still give them the chance to reach the people who have chosen to follow them, but make sure that your algorithm doesn't broadcast them to people who don't want that type of stuff in their feeds. You could see this being applied to someone like Alex Jones. You could see it being applied to all sorts of folks who may indeed have the right to speak, but you know, who a lot of people just don't want to hear, and a lot of what they say might be really offensive to people who aren't already in their camp or haven't chosen to seek that out.
So just to be clear, if someone has a problem with Twitter, they should contact you first, right? And did you want to give your phone number?
Thank you for that opportunity, Megan.
So you are just a writer, a senior writer at 1-0 for Medium. You're writing about people's problems, only occasionally solving them or trying to solve them. I did not
solve Satan's problems. But I'll update you if anything changes. I told him to get in touch if he ever finds himself reinstated somehow, or if he ever hears from Twitter. But he still hasn't so far.
I mean, this sort of made me think of how everyone thinks that their phone is listening to them because you see the Facebook ad that you just talked about, when we know it's not really listening to us. But like, there's so many signals, we have no idea like what all the advertising signals are coming at us to show us these ads, and we'll never know because they're these black boxes. And it's So I need to know why Satan isn't more popular on Twitter.
I mean, the algorithm is a double-edged sword. I mean, it can make you go viral and make you extremely popular for reasons that are opaque. And now we're learning that when these social platforms try to undo that, they can also catch up maybe innocent accounts and make them harder to find for reasons that are just as opaque.
Willa Remus is a senior writer at 1-0 for Medium. You can read this full story plus Will's coverage of Google I.O. at 1-0.medium.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Megan.
Take care. So after the break, I have never bought my children a gaming system, and Owen J.J. Stone has something to say about it. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by FreshBooks, the number one accounting software that takes the pain and frustration out of the billing process. From starting a project to accepting a payment, you will spend less time on your paperwork and more time doing the work you love when you use FreshBooks. FreshBooks lets you create professional-looking invoices in just a few seconds. It'll let you record expenses automatically and track your time quickly and efficiently so you can focus on what matters most, serving the needs of your clients. Now, if you have accounting experience, great. But if you don't, no worries. FreshBooks will do the hard stuff for you. Here's a little sampling of what FreshBooks can do. They will create and send invoices. You can use it to accept credit card payments. No more chasing clients for checks. Log every expense by taking a picture with your smartphone. Stay on budget for every project by tracking what you've spent. Track your productivity. They have easy to understand reports, multi-currency billing, automatic tax calculations, and there's so much more. As a hardworking small business owner, you are constantly evolving to keep up with your customer and industry demands. FreshBooks ensures you have all the information and tools you need to understand and grow your business. FreshBooks mobile app has revolutionized the software accounting world. Imagine being able to communicate with clients, get paid, and organize your expenses all from the palm of your hand. Small business owners in over 120 countries trust FreshBooks. Join over 24 million people who have used FreshBooks. Visit freshbooks.com/TNW and enter Tech News Weekly in the How Did You Hear About Us section to receive 30 days free. That's freshbooks.com/TNW and enter Tech News Weekly and you get 30 days free. And we thank FreshBooks for their support. So last week, Scott Stein from CNET gave us his review of the upcoming Oculus Quest mobile VR system. And this week, my 14-year-old twins decided that they absolutely, positively needed this VR system. Between the two of them, they have saved around $400, which is what the headset will cost. It does not require a gaming PC, which they do not have, but it will require an additional purchase of games, which they didn't really understand since I have never bought them a gaming system. That is right. That's correct. You heard me correctly. Aside from friends' houses, they've never had their very own gaming console. All the games they've played have been on iPads and iPhones. They know they love VR because they've played it here with all of Leo's VR system. But part of why I give them allowance is so that they can learn to save and choose how to spend their own money. But I wasn't sure that the Oculus Quest was worth $400 for two teenagers who've never had a gaming system. So I tweeted this, and you guys gave me some good advice. But I also got this video from friend of the show, Owen J.J. Stone, about the fact that I had not bought them a gaming system. And here's that video.
Megan, well, I got a minute now. I was busy all day. Like I said, the kid was sick. I got to rush again. What are you doing? Obviously, you sending that tweet means you are out here crying for help. There's no way in the world that you didn't get a Wii system for your children. You ain't never beat your kids down in Mario Kart. You never family Wii Bowl with the kids. As an evangelist for technology and someone who loves technology, you out here giving out iPads as gaming systems? Okay, this is wrong. You are a neglectful parent. I love you, and you're a great mom, but the kids deserve better than this. Matter of fact, I don't want to hear about these kids spending their own money on this game system. You owe these kids a game system. Kids, if you're listening, tell your mom, Uncle O said she's buying the system. They want to spend their hard-earned money on some games. Go ahead, let them get some games. There's no way in the world they have to buy their first system on their own with their own dime. No, sir. You should take care of these children. I love you, but you got to do better than this. No Wii U, no nothing? You ain't never just played a fun family game on the digital? Whoo, I can't. Oh, I'm sorry, kids. I know she loves you, but you got to do better than this. Fix it!
Yes, I'm all out here giving out iPads as gaming systems. That is what I'm doing. A few of you in the chat room have made some comments. If they've saved $400 from their allowance, that they get paid too much. They get paid, I think it's like $5 a week. They don't get paid. We don't call it paid. It's just allowance. And they just never spend money. And they've been saving it for a long time. I don't know. What do you think? Am I a horrible mother? Should I pay for the gaming system and let them pay for the games? Yes. And others of you have pointed out that Owen is now their new best friend. Yes, that's true. I showed them this video and they're 100% team Owen on this, not surprisingly. But what about you? I want to know. Find me at Megan Maroney on Twitter or email me at megan@twit.tv. Let me know what you think. Yes to VR, no to VR. Specifically the Oculus Quest. And also, if you want to tell me I'm a terrible mother, that's fine. Do that too. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. You can subscribe to our show at twit.tv/tnw. Please do that. Whatever podcast app you use, subscribe so that you're the first to know when we put out a new episode. And then follow us on the socials, the Twitter, the Instagram. We're at Twit. We're at Twit Live. Just search Twit on every social. We're there. And I want to thank Alex and both of the Johns. And I especially want to thank you for watching, for listening, and for subscribing. And we'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. That was ouch. Thank you.